History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me and before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave. And go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Is called The Slave Auction. It was written by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, a black lady poet writing in the 1850s. This was after she had seen an auction. The sale began. Young girls were there, defenseless in their wretchedness, whose stifled sobs and deep despair revealed the anguish of their breast. And women stood with streaming eyes and saw their dearest children sold. Unheeded rose their bitter cries as tyrants bartered them for gold. And men whose sole crime was their hue, the impress of their maker's hand, and small and trembling children too were gathered in that mournful band. And women, with their love and truth, for those in sable forms do dwell, gazed on the lovers of their youth with anguish none may paint nor tell. You who have laid your loves to rest and wept above that lifeless clay, know not the anguish of the breast whose loves are rudely torn away. The sale began.
Hotep, my brothers and sisters, greetings to all of you. I welcome you to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers, and I am here with you every Tuesday night from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on timeforanawakening.com. I hope your day has been productive and relaxing. It was a rainy day here in Lithonia, Georgia. Temperature was about 50 degrees. But nevertheless, I hope your day was productive and you got some things done that you wanted to do. Our program, the Black Reality Think Tank, is sponsored by Motherland Media, and it is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. And as always, we sincerely thank all of you, our listening audience, for your patronage and your continued support of our program activities. The Black Reality Think Tank is an information sharing and discussion-oriented program. Its goal and objective is to understand the past, dissect the present, and support implementing a meaningful future. One of the beliefs here, and the name of our program today, is all of history is a current event. All of history is a current event. And we promote that idea. And the other part of our thought process here is that you will never know where you're going unless you understand from whence you came. And so that is why we exist here at the Black Reality Think Tank, and that is what we are trying to do. We have a wonderful program lined up for you this evening. A wonderful gentleman, Berg Siding, comes with an extensive background of history, and we are just going to get him to share with us some of his wonderful experience and some of the work that he's doing in our community to educate our people. So it is an honor for me to do that. This is a call-in format. I just want to let our listening audience know, those of you who are listening via the Internet, if you decide you would like to call in or either ask a question, the telephone number here is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. And at any point, you can give us a call. We'll see you on the switchboard, and we will get to you as soon as we can and give you an opportunity to join our conversation tonight. Our guest is Mr. Gene Peters, and I'm going to be bringing him on in just a second. But as you know, on the Black Reality Think Tank, we always do what we call our ancestral profile. We look at one of our ancestors on whose shoulders we stand. As I've often said, you know, we believe in the message of the great Fannie Lou Hamer. You must always praise the bridges that brought you over. But tonight we're going to do something just a little different. I'm not going to profile an individual. I'm going to profile an incident, which fits right into our discussion with Mr. Peters tonight. And that incident is the New York Slave Revolt of 1712. The New York Slave Revolt of 1712. The New York Slave Revolt of 1712 was an uprising in New York City in the British Province of New York. It consisted of 23 enslaved Africans. They killed 9 whites and injured another 6 before they were stopped. More than 3 times that number of Africans, 70 were arrested and jailed. And of these, 27 were put on trial, and 21 were convicted and executed. In the 18th century New York City, it had one of the largest slave populations of any of England's colonies. Slavery in the city differed from some of the other colonies because there was no large plantations. The enslaved Africans worked as domestic servants. They worked as artisans, dock workers, and various skilled laborers. The enslaved Africans lived near each other, making communications easy. They also often worked among what John Hope Franklin called the quasi-free Africans. It was a situation that did not exist on most southern plantations. The Africans in the city could communicate, and they could plan activities, such as a conspiracy, more easily than among those on the big plantations. Events that presumably led to the revolt included a decrease in freedom and status when the English took over the colony. In 1664, the Dutch controlled much of New York. At that time, it was called New Netherland. And the enslaved Africans had some rights, such as the rights to own land and to marry. But after the English took over, that was all stopped. Those laws were changed, tighter restrictions began, and a slave market was built near the present-day what we call Wall Street to accommodate the increase in slaves being imported by the Royal African Company. By the early 1700s, about 20% of the population were enslaved African people. The colonial government restricted this group through several measures, requiring the Africans to carry a pass if traveling more than a mile from home, discouraging marriages among them, prohibiting gatherings in groups of more than three persons, and requiring them to sit in separate galleries at church services. A group of more than 20 Africans gathered on the night of April 6, 1712, and set fire to a building on Maiden Lane near what is now Broadway. While the white colonists tried to put out the fire, the enslaved Africans, armed with guns, hatchets, and swords, attacked the whites and then ran off what was soon recaptured. The colonial forces arrested 70 blacks and jailed them. Six are reported to have committed suicide. 27 were put on trial, and 21 of whom were convicted and sentenced to death. 20 were burned to death, and one was executed on what was called a breaking wheel. This was a form of punishment no longer used on whites at the time. The severity of that punishment was an expression of the white slave owners' fear of slave insurrections. They wanted to instill fear into the Africans. After the revolt, the city and the colony passed more restrictive laws governing black and Native American slaves. The captured Africans were not permitted to gather in groups of more than three. They were not permitted to carry firearms. Gambling was outlawed. Crimes of property damage, rape, and conspiracy to kill qualified for the death penalty. The Africans were still allowed to own land, however. And there was one African by the name of Anthony Portuguese who owned land that makes up a portion of present-day Washington Square Park. The New York Slave Revolt of 1712. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, as I said today, we are going to be talking with a wonderful gentleman. His name is Mr. Gene Alexander Peters. Gene Alexander Peters, and I want to tell you just a little bit about him. I'm so impressed with the things that he's done, and I just couldn't wait to get him on our program and have him talk about some of these magnificent ventures that he has been a part of. Gene Alexander Peters is a historian. He is an educator, educational consultant, and a noted heritage collector. With his private collection, which is called the Gene Alexander Peters Collection of Rare and Historic African-American Artifacts. Mr. Peters designs and curates exhibitions and historical displays that lend a visual and physical documentation as to the history of African-American experience in the Americas. For over 20 years, Mr. Peters' collection and artifacts have been featured at numerous landmark institutions and museums, including the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, New York, one of my favorite places, and the Smithsonian Museum Anacostia in Washington, D.C. In addition, several of his select items have been showcased in various books and publications, such as Jubilee, The Emergence of the African-American Culture, and another called Captive Passage, The Transatlantic Slave Trade and the Making of America. He's also, his work was featured on NBC TV television production of Roots, celebrating 25 years. Proudly, in October of 2016, Mr. Peters was invited by the founding members of the original Black Panther Party to exhibit several artifacts from his Black Panther Party archives at the official 50th anniversary conference of the founding of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. As an educator and consultant, Mr. Peters has given research assistance to people like Oprah Winfrey in production, in her wonderful production of the novel Beloved, which was written by the great Toni Morrison. He also aided into the New Jersey Amistad Commission and has presented at international cultural history conferences in Senegal in 2000, 2001, Ghana 2003, and Brazil in 2005. In more recent years, Mr. Peters has had the wonderful privilege and honor to have been invited to exhibit and collaborate on several significant cultural history projects with legendary African-American icons such as Elia Bundles, who is the great-great-granddaughter of Madam C.J. Walker, the late jazz legend Randy Weston, filmmaker and documentarian Sandy Nelson, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Taheemba Jess, and Tony Award-winning director and actor Ruben Santiago Hudson. Mr. Peters received his undergraduate and graduate degrees from Buffalo State University, where he also minored in African-American studies and has conducted his postmaster doctoral level research in the area of African-American college student leadership development. He has received numerous awards and citations for his cultural history advocacy, including from the Schomburg Collection in Harlem, the African Burial Ground Project, which is definitely what we want to talk a little bit about tonight, and the New York City Council honoring Robert E. Carnegie, Jr., who was a council member and is a past member of the National Council on Educating Black Children, and the Association of African American Museums, and the Board of the Education of People of African Ancestry, headquartered at the Dr. John Henry Clark House in Harlem, New York. And on June 2017, Mr. Peters was elected to the president of the Schomburg Corporation, the officially chartered independent advisory affiliate to the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, headquartered in Harlem, New York. As also, he had a 20-plus year college administrator of the State University of New York. Mr. Peters continues in his private practice as a collector, consultant, and researcher in the applied area of African-American history. He remains true to his personal mantra, the African principle of Sankofa: one must know one's past in order to chart one's future. We got a brother that's ready, and I am so happy that he is here with us, and I am honored to have been able to reach out and grab him. So let me bring him on. Good evening, Brother Peters. How are you doing tonight?
Pretty good, sir. Pretty good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on, and thank you for that wonderful build-up.
Thank you.
I had to kind of listen to it myself. Thank you, my brother.
Oh, yes, indeed. I really appreciate you and the work that you are doing. I'm just so honored to have you here. And so we're going to get right on into the conversation. I got one. When I first read this, I said, I got to ask him this first. Because this is powerful. This is one of my favorite books, was Toni Morrison's Beloved. Tell us a little bit about what you did in that film that Oprah reproduced in that book. I would love to know that, because that is one of my favorite movies of all time.
I was really, really honored. Thank you for that. Yeah, I was really honored that when I first started my consulting work, members of her production company had reached out. And actually, I wasn't familiar with how Hollywood worked, but evidently some of the major producing and production companies do then have subcontractors and subcompanies that actually then look to people that might either have expertise or things to lend to the work. So it was an African-American affiliate of one of her production companies that kind of just reached out to me, and they realized I was a new new collector at the time, but they were fortunate that they had seen some of the work I had previously done. So they reached out, and they had wanted some artifacts that I might have in the collection, authentic artifacts that they thought would lend to some of their background, you know, investigation of the time, their background documentation of the time, especially if I had certain newspapers, which I had several in my collection that actually had either ads for the runaway slave ads, if you will, or just contemporary articles. So I was, you know, very fortunate that they reached out to me. It was Lennox Productions, was one of their subcontractors.
Right.
And I was very, you know, honored that I, you know, they reached out. I definitely had some articles that were from about the early 1800s into the 1840s. So it was right around the time that the period was, that the movie was shot, that the period of the movie was indicated. And I was able to then put them and actually then give them to the production company. You know, they remunerated in terms of what their standard fees were, but it really wasn't about the money for me. It was just the honor of being included in that initiative, and also their availability, because, you know, several times they had just contacted me just in terms of some of the information I might just know about some of the conditions of the time. I guess to hear it from someone else that's outside of their production team, but also then to get the artifacts into their possession that they could contextualize when they were doing their research. So it was one of the first major initiatives that I was able to involve myself with. And, you know, I felt really honored to have been, you know, even a small part of it, but at least from the information and research point of view, I was glad to give some kind of offering to them.
Yeah. It was loaded symbolically with things in relationship to the African past. And I really did
definitely
appreciate that work.
Definitely.
Dr. Morrison did a powerful job. It's a fictional piece, but she did a powerful job of giving us a feeling of what that time was like right after the enslavement period ended, supposedly.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, I wanted to launch right in there. So, okay, let's really get into a little bit about, you know, your collection and your archival work.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a little bit of background about how you started, why you started it. What were some of the, you know, first things that you might have done, you know? But just basically, why did you do this, and how did you think it would be significant?
Sure. I've always been interested in education, and I've always been interested in history. As you mentioned, my minor was actually African American Studies up in college.
Right.
I'm from New York, and coming up through the New York Board of Ed, we never had any black studies, really even had a black teacher. So, you know, I'm sure many of us nationally in the audience, you know, understand that kind of circumstance. So not really knowing or having learned anything about my history, our history, but I know I've always had just a burning to know more, to, you know, be radical, if you will, to, you know, just to say, hey, what about this? So the first opportunity educationally that I had to even see a black studies class was in college, and, you know, I definitely gravitated to that because I'm realizing that there's a bunch of stuff that I don't know. And while I know history per se, and American history, and even world history, I don't know our history, and also how our history relates and is incorporated, or the lack of incorporation in the history, but how it's integral to the whole body of history. So that's how I got into it in terms of structurally, academically, and of course just doing independent research and readings, and really then trying to then just bring my mind up to speed with all the lost years that had been given. But I think it was good because, again, I was able then to juxtapose, you know, this newfound history, this black history, African-American history, the history of our people, and relate it against what I then learned of their history or the history that they told it. So I think I was able better to even then, you know, contextualize, get a better understanding, and then even, you know, refute where there may have been issues that had been omitted. And now when we add our history to that, they get a better understanding of the whole dynamic of history. So,
exactly.
So that's how I got into that, you know, in terms of educationally
and I can see how that can happen, because New York very clearly had a lot of things that were going on. You know, you had down in Harlem, you had the Michelle's bookstore, you had you had Liberation Books, you had all kind of different stuff going on, and some of the greatest minds, the literary minds in the world, operated out of New York City. And so, you know, you get embraced in all of that. And I'm sure that I can see how that might have catapulted you into moving into a larger arena. So that's excellent. That's excellent. Okay. I also wanted to ask about your project that you were recently engaged in, which is one that we actually used in our promotion of the program today, was the burial ground in Lower Manhattan. So, yeah, why don't you give our audience a little background about that whole situation, you know, as much as you can, just to bring them up to date in case they may not know about what that's all about and where it is now, what has happened now with it.
Got it. Yeah, it's a very timely that you mentioned that. Yeah, the African burial grounds here in New York that, you know, a lot of people still don't know about, but again, it's of national scope.
Right.
It's down in Lower Manhattan, and it's actually at 290 Broadway. It's the location. It's at Duane Street and Reed Street, just off of Broadway. And what had happened was in the early 90s, when the federal government was actually constructing a building, on some land that was down there, they started, you know, to uncover bones. And initially, they didn't realize or know the significance of the bones. But when researchers and some white scholars at first started to then share of what those bones might have been, and then obviously brought in, you know, some of the black scholarship and black, you know, anthropologist with it. At that point, the federal government, unfortunately, still then did not have any sacredness in terms of trying to preserve the site or trying to even respect what that symbolism was. And they went, tried to continue on with the construction.
Okay.
And it was only because of the grassroots efforts of, say, Dr. John Henry Clark and, you know, Regent Adlai Sanford and, you know, Reverend Herbert Daughtry and community activists who at the point had to sit in the hole. And they say that even symbolically and physically, when the construction trucks were trying to come to excavate the site.
Right.
So it was covered on a lot of the national news coverage just in terms of that the community then realized, wait, our people, you know, this is a historical burial grounds that our people are buried under, and you're disrespecting it with this building. So it went up through the whole city level. Dave Dinkins was mayor at the time, and, you know, it went up through even to the federal government with Conyers and national hearings, and obviously the federal government was very reluctant to even recognize it and even to give any kind of, you know, recognition in terms of, you know, the sacred nature of it. And it was only through the auspices of the grassroots of the community activists and the people, then with their outcry and obviously having the necessary scholarship and documentation, that the federal government finally then, you know, reluctantly decided that they were going to then make some kind of monument there. So just updating the story, and again, there's a lot of, obviously a lot of controversy that went on in terms of what we felt the federal government could do and should do and did not do. But, you know, updating the story, the building actually was built, the federal building was built, but they did parcel off a plot of the land where it's then actually preserved and demarked and denoted as the African burial grounds. The land in and of itself, you know, it spanned about 10 acres. It's right on Chambers Street. If anyone's familiar with New York City, it's just north, the block north of City Hall. And that was actually the outskirts of New York at the time, because the city wall was at Chambers Street. So you're looking at late 1693 to about 1792.
Okay.
was when we black people, Negroes, could not be buried in church grounds. We had to be buried outside of the city limits. So that was where all of our ancestors were being buried, just outside of city limits in what was a swampy, marshy area. Mm-hmm. And it's estimated there are about 20,000 souls that are buried. They are still buried, you know, but in terms of what they've excavated was actually 491 of the remains of our ancestors. So a lot more are still there than even we know about.
Okay. There's a very good possibility that some of the individuals who were involved in that New York slave revolt, 1712, may have been buried there.
Correct.
Is that correct? Yeah, that's right. I know I had read that before.
Correct.
Let me ask you, is that, I mentioned in terms of that background history a little bit, and I should have also wanted to, for our listening audience, if you wanted to read about the New York slave revolt of 1712, there are a couple of real good sources. One is a book by Ira Berlin and Leslie Harris called Slavery in New York, New York. It was published in 2005, and it's a New Press publication. Again, it's called Slavery in New York, and it's by Ira Berlin and Leslie Harris. And then there's another book by William Lauren Katz called Black Legacy, A History of New York's African Americans. That was also published in 1997. So these are some sources that you might want to take a look at. But, you know, one of the things that I did find that I wanted to ask you about was that the brother that bought the land in New York, the brother Portuguese, and I did mention him, and it says that his family still owns a part of Washington Square Park. Is that true?
That I had not officially seen documented. You know, I know that I've never seen any kind of documentation or know of anything. Like, I'd heard that in the past, but nothing that's ever come across, you know, my awareness in terms of that. I know in terms of that area down there, most, if not all of it, was purchased by New York University.
Okay.
So they own a lion's share of all that land still down there. So that I'm not sure of.
Okay. All right. I just wondered, and I think this one of the writings did mention the fact that it was still owned. But anyway, okay, let me ask about the, okay, now, there was recently a play done by the National Black Theater. Is that the name of it, correct?
Yeah, it was the American Slavery Project, and they hosted their final performance at the National Black Theater this weekend, yes.
Okay. Now, and what was that doing? I know there's a YouTube of some of the production. Tell us a little bit about that and what the writer was trying to do in that production.
Yeah, that's a very interesting project, and I was, you know, kind of, you know, really, again, honored to, you know, be involved and to be asked to do something with it. And I wound up doing the exhibition for them. Judy Tate is a playwright, and her play company, the American Slavery Project, what they had done was to commission about 20 African American writers of note. Dominique Morisseau is one of the writers, Keith Joseph Atkins, one of the writers, several, you know, young African-American playwrights. And what their charge was, and this is a few years back, mm-hmm. what their charge was to research from the information that was given about our ancestors who are buried and then reinterred in the African burial grounds, the 491 remains that were then excavated and the research done at Howard University, and then they were reinterred. But the major issue is no one knows their names because the graves were unmarked. So all you'd have is the forensic information and the skeletal remains and the research that had been done at Howard by Dr. Blakey, Michael Blakey. So the charge to these playwrights and writers was based upon the information that you have on the different individuals, to then give them voice. And, you know, what then would some of their circumstances be? And just to then empower ourselves to be able to speak on behalf of our ancestors so that we bring some life to the bones, that we bring them symbolically back to life, that their voices can be heard through contemporary people. So these writers actually wrote various plays and monologues and skits. And that's what the American Slavery Project actually does, is they take those monologues, skits, and plays that were written by these, you know, fantastic young African-American writers, and they have contemporary African-American actors and actresses that actually then perform these and, you know, again, bringing words and voice to of our ancestors, just so that we all remember. So I thought it was a very phenomenal project and initiative in terms of bringing everything full circle, and also from a present-day point of view, remembering the past and actually giving full homage to the past in terms of bringing voice to those who were voiceless at the time and those who are nameless now. So they had invited me to come with my artifacts, and I do have a series of artifacts that I actually had curated for the African Burial Grounds, that I was able to set up a lobby exhibit that, you know, brought another visual dynamic to the production that was done. So that was hosted at the National Black Theater just last Friday. My days are a little blurry here, but last Friday evening was the final performance at the National Black Theater. So it was it went over very well. The audience was very capturing, captivated, and you know, the actors that bring the words and bring the voice and give life to that, you know, are all very dynamic, and they're all very professional, and they're all very sincere in it. The writing is phenomenal, and the whole production just went over quite well in terms of having that opportunity to, you know, be in touch, if you will, with our past and go from there. And then they had a talk back session where the artists and actors and actresses actually gave a lot of personal, you know, spin, if you will, in terms of just what they had gone through to get themselves into character, if you will, and also, you know, just the importance of trying to be the voice of our ancestors. So I was just very, you know, humbled to have, you know, even been there and, you know, to have given some kind of educational and academic offering to that affair.
Okay, excellent. That's excellent. What about the, what were some of the things that you did present there?
Sure. I had several, you know, historical panel pieces giving some of the history of the African burial grounds for those who did not know. And some of the artifacts from my personal collection, I have a 1753 bill of sale for, you know, an ancestor from New York City.
Okay.
I have an 1812 bill of sale from New York City. I have an 1822 manumission paper and document from New York City. That one's from Queens. And I also brought an 1817 mariner's certificate that was actually issued to an African-American sailor, allowing him to actually then be a steward on a ship. So I brought several documents, official and original documents. I brought some of my, you know, original slave shackles and instruments of torture. You know, the neck collar was there, the spiked neck collar, and the ankle chains, the chain with the ball, and some of those were featured in the book at the Schomburg. They had been on exhibit at the Schomburg. So I brought some of those artifacts of enslavement. And I also brought some newspapers from about 1808 from New York City also, that actually had the ads where they're advertising for either Negro boy or Negro girl wanted or to be sold. So again, I wanted to bring some of the artifacts that were particular to New York and to this area, but also to making sure that the artifacts that I brought were symbolic, and also all the original documents I have do have our ancestors' names on them.
Okay.
And it's important that when I do look for a document or purchase a document, I like it, number one, to have provenance, but I also like it to have some documentation, because I want to give, you know, the respect that was not given.
How are you able to collect those items? Where were you able to find them? What did you have to do to go about getting hold of shackles and things like that?
It depends. I've been collecting for over 20 years now, so okay. A lot of these shackles that I've, you know, acquired over the last, you know, years. Initially, one of my associates, Danny Drain, he actually has with his collection, a young collector, he and his wife founded and started a museum down in South Carolina, okay. The Slave Relics Museum in Walterboro, South Carolina. So years ago, Danny and I had, you know, worked together to kind of acquire shackles, and, you know, he had a great points of contact in the South. And there were pickers, as you would call them, that actually go onto the plantations and find these things. And there are a lot of things still available, still out there. You just have to find them. Okay. But we actually came into possession of, you know, some of the original shackles off of slave plantations in South Carolina and Georgia. Mm-hmm. Some of the newspapers I usually get from antiquarian newspaper dealers. Some of my first edition books, I deal with first edition, you know, antiquarian book vendors. And the documents I wind up either getting through private purchase or through sometimes if there's a museum sale or if I'm able to find them at, you know, at auction. So I, you know, try to acquire it any way that I can. Obviously, you know, whatever price points would need to be there. But it's just trying to get it as a collector to find, you know, who might have something, is it available, right. And, you know, is it something that hopefully I can acquire.
Okay. Uh-huh. That's interesting. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Schomburg and what some of the things that they're doing there. I know there's a lot of always exciting ideas, a lot of exciting things. I imagine most of their work now is digitized. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, not most of it. I mean, they've digitized a great amount of it. That's an ongoing process up at the Schomburg.
Right.
Truthfully, they've just scratched the surface in terms of the amount of items that they have in terms of being digitally available.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the other, you know, the items there are still, you know, researchable and obviously microfichable, and actually that you actually then have the copies that you're working with. So they have over, I want to say it's over 3 million, you know, documents and items, and, you know, it's a continual thing of then getting all of the original documents to have them digitized as a, you know, an ongoing and ever-going process. And they're acquiring, you know, new things all the time as an institution. So, you know, Kevin Young is the new executive director there, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, he took over since Dr. Khalil Muhammad is up at Harvard. So Kevin Young, you know, he's doing a great job in terms of continuing that legacy of the Schomburg Center, for sure.
Right. You know, I lived in New York during the 60s and 70s, and I used to go to the 135th Street branch of the Public Library, which is what it was called
mm-hmm.
at the time. And I did some of my graduate work on that. I did something on Ernestine Rose, right, who was the librarian who opened the door for allowing, you know, some of those books and works, because at one time it was a library for Jewish people, I understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she opened it up for the African American experience, and some of the ideas that behind that is powerful. I'm wondering right now who's using it. We find a lot of scholars that are coming in there and community people as well. How is it being used by the community?
Lots of scholars use it, and it's also used as a, you know, community center. I say that meaning that there are a lot of events and, you know, educational programs
right.
that actually happen through there. But I will back up too in terms of, as you shared and as you mentioned, I'm glad you did mention, in terms of some of the history of the Schomburg Center, that, you know, when, you know, about 1925 is when, so, you know, as part of the New York Public Library system, turn of the century, Harlem, that's when the migration of African Americans, you know, really started, with emphasis late 1800s, early 1900s, and Harlem was changing in terms of being the black Mecca that, you know, it was turning into. And it was 1925 when the mission of the library that was located there became in terms of to service the needs of the Black and African and Caribbean community. And it was Arturo Schomburg. And, you know, a lot of people don't know the name Arturo Schomburg as a Black man of Puerto Rican descent. And it was his initial collection. He started as a private collector. And it was his initial private collection that was donated and sold to the New York Public Library System that was the start and founding of the Schomburg Center in 1925. And that's why the center was named after him, Arturo Schomburg, as a Black man and his collection. And from there it grew into what it is as the great repository that it is now. So I say that to say that, you know, a lot of people don't realize the, you know, grassroots origins of the Schomburg Center. They don't realize the length and longevity that the Schomburg Center has been there. And also in terms of all the different great scholars, as you mentioned, that have come through over the 90-plus years and, you know, still being utilized, still being very active and into the current day where you have a lot of programs that might be there, a lot of speaker series go on there. And, you know, people should definitely, you know, just Google them and get on, because they do have a Schomburg Connections newsletter that is available, that if you go to Schomburg Center site, you can sign up for it. Because, again, they have a lot of great educational things that come through that are available to the public, for sure.
Right. Okay. One of the things I wanted to do today, I wanted to do a kind of like a two-part. I wanted to talk about, first of all, the collections and, you know, what they were and what do you consist of. And then at the top of the hour when we go, I want to talk a little bit more on the theoretical aspects of it. And what is it that, when you do a display, what is it that you're trying to achieve? What type of impact do you want to leave on an audience and so forth and so on? Before I do that, I want to ask about the one in Washington, the museum in Washington. Have you contributed to that as well in some of your work?
I'm a charter member of that, you know, in Lonnie Branch first, you know, unveiled it years ago. I definitely became a charter member of it. And I was actually went down there. I was there on opening day, and I was very fortunate. And one of my one piece from my collection was actually purchased through a third party gallery, and is there. It's the North Star, the Frederick Douglass North Star, the 1848 Frederick Douglass North Star. You know, had come from my collection, and you know, is now, you know, on display down there, owned by the by the National Museum. So I felt really good that it was able to then find appropriate and a proper, you know, long-term home that, you know, it can actually be viewed by, you know, millions of people.
Okay. You know, I know it's always been, in terms of my own research, there's always a politic with a lot of these museums and libraries. I remember going into the New York Public Library Rare Book Section on 42nd Street, trying to get some information based on J.A. Rogers' book, The Five Negro Presidents. And what I was doing is I wanted to look up the thing on Warren G. Harding. And I recall that this was around 1967, 68. And I remember that librarian giving me such a hard time in getting hold of that book that Rogers used to document the possibility of Warren G. Harding's heritage being African. It wasn't so much that it was there. I finally did get hold of it. I had to stay there about 4 hours before I got it. He wouldn't let me. I couldn't take in any pencils, no paper. I couldn't take anything into that room, which was that rare book section room. So as an archivist, has some of that opened up a little bit more now? Are people a little bit more willing to, you know, not use their bigotry and prohibit you from accessing important stuff? Is that opened up now?
I can't speak for the New York Public Library in terms of that. I know the Schomburg Center, obviously, their staff is very amenable to researchers and scholars. I would hope that the New York Public Library System so too is, But again, not knowing or trusting folks who then have that kind of understanding, I would then understand that it's possibly just like with anything else that, you know, peoples would have to do their due diligence and hold, you know, even library officials or library workers, you know, accountable for doing what they're supposed to do, you know, because, you know, the New York Public Library system is still an entity of New York City, is still an entity of the system, if you will.
Right.
Fortunately, the Schomburg Center is a place, although still under the New York Public Library system, it has the mission on behalf of the people, our people. And again, with the staff there, you know, those, you know, that staff, you know, is more sensitive to that. And I would then hope that the rest of the New York Public Library system staff do know that they have that responsibility to share information with all people, all times.
Okay, and I agree. I think, yeah. So I'm hoping that it is, too. I haven't been there in a while, but I hope
it's
a little bit more open. We've got a couple of callers online. I'm going to see if they want to say something before we go into the more of the theoretical position. Brother Timothy, how are you doing tonight from Philadelphia? How are you?
Sir, I'm doing very well, sir. And how are you, sir?
Doing well.
A very dynamic guest you have on. Mr. Peterson, how are you, sir?
Sorry, thank you, sir. Fine, thank you. Thank you for your call, sir. Thank you.
Yes, sir. I want to chime in on what you're saying, sir. I'm a Philadelphian, born in Philadelphia. And I had an experience, sir, of going to Lincoln University. Undergrad, and I did my graduate work at a place called Beaver College and now called Arcadia. And I live in South Philadelphia. I'm from both places, West Philadelphia and South Philadelphia. I'm now back in South Philadelphia. And you have brought out a situation that's very important, very similar to what happened in South Philadelphia, the same thing that happened in New York. There's a place called Mother Bethel at 6th and Lombard, and Rich Allen was the minister there. And it's in a place called the 6th Ward at 6th and Lombard, the 6th and 7th Ward. The interesting thing in the history about that area is Du Bois, when he was on the staff of University of Penn, he was the Philadelphia Negro. And he was the Philadelphia Negro compatible and comparing and telling people about that area where African Americans live.
Brother now, Timothy, I'm getting a feedback from you. Are you? Do you have your computer on or something on in the back? Because it's picking up an echo. It's like a feedback.
No, sir. I made sure I sat in the kitchen where there's no noise. I'll move, and you can tell me if it sounds better.
It sounds like it's a radio on or something to that effect. But go right ahead. Go ahead. Uh-huh.
Okay. Is it better now?
No, I still hear it. But go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm hearing you, sir. I'm hearing you.
Okay, but my thing is, sir, is that at this place in 6th and Lombard, where Mother Bethel is, there's a graveyard not too far from there at 4th Queen. Now, that's Mother Bethel's gravesite. And over top of that gravesite, as years went on, they built a playground. Now, we found out later in time that that's Mother Bethel's grave site with all the bodies of Africans in that area. Now, at this present time, there's a group called ATTACK, Avenging the Ancestors. And Michael Kord is one of the heads of that. And right now, he's fighting the city to get that burial ground back, which belongs to Mother Bethel. Now, I'm telling you that because how important it is, because can you hear me? Is everything okay?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, the important thing about this place, with Richard Allen Church, Mother Bethel, is that O.B. Plato went to a university, but now called university, which is called the Youth for Colored Education, Youth for Colored Youth. It's called now CHAIN. Cato graduated from there, and a gentleman by the name of Julian A. Abel. Now, at this present time, he's trying his best to make sure that the mayor gives us that playground back with all those bodies. Very significant what's going on in New York, and it's very interesting what you're saying. And the meaning that I'm happy to talk to you from the Shonda. I could punch myself in the mouth for never going there in Philadelphia. My mother has been to the Schomburg, and it's also a restaurant called Sylvia's. And I need to take myself to the Schomburg. But I'm interested about the history that you're giving me, because it's very similar to what's going on in Philadelphia.
Okay. I thank you for sharing that, and I heard some of that, you know, story in terms of going on down there. The good thing I would say is that at least, you know, these other archaeological finds, you know, can at least hopefully pattern themselves after what had happened with the African burial grounds. And again, it was a struggle. It continues to be a struggle, even with the African burial grounds, even though now it's under the auspices of the National Parks Service in terms of their continued, you know, fundings and all. But I say that in terms of just the game plan as to what can be done, and also then the educational potential, because if that land is actually then utilized not just for a parking lot, but as an educational learning center on behalf of the people, and in representation and in respect for the people who are interred under, you can actually have the best of all worlds and actually then go into the future. But it's just a matter of bringing that vision to people. Again, maybe people don't want the vision. They could have some ulterior motive, absolutely. But at least that way, you know, the people know what can be done, so then they can't say they don't know. They can't say it cannot be done. Yes, it can be done. It's do you want to do it? Be you the mayor, you be the city council, be you the governor, be you whomever, do you want to do it? But again, it can be done. It has been done. And it could be a win-win for everybody. Right. And so I think that a lot of other peoples and situations have learned from just how the African burial grounds was fought for and fought on behalf of and what it then came to be, and now can use that as a model or a template for all of these other initiatives that are out there for sure.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Brother Timothy. I'm going to come back to you in a minute. I've got some other folk here online that I want to grab. Oakland, California, area code 510-934. Good afternoon, caller.
Yes, good afternoon, William. This is Phil Doggett. And good afternoon, George. Or good evening, excuse me. It's early evening here in the South of you, later in the East Coast. So I just wanted to chime in and just say and congratulate George or Mr. Peters, if you will, for all of the great work. And what I've been able to listen and enjoy in this program is just, it's exciting and it's encouraging for all of us who are out there sharing the same mission, which is to document and preserve and tell the stories of our ancestors from differing perspectives. So I just wanted to share that and say that. And also congratulate. Oh, you're very welcome. And Clint, I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
No, you go right ahead. Uh-huh.
Okay. And just congratulating for Mr. Peters for having what I consider a breakthrough moment with Lonnie Bunch and the National Museum, because that has not always been so easy. There are a number of us out in California who have had a different experience. But I'm glad that the very important Frederick Douglass newspaper, which is also exceptionally rare. I also have a museum, what I call a historical newspaper museum, that's focused more on performing arts and also in resistance and the abolitionist era. It's hard to find these days. And as you mentioned, in a particular sense, the anniversary of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation a couple of years back, it has just become extremely expensive. So I'm glad that you have yours. I'm glad that there are others who have made a point of preserving and that we respectively and collectively are willing to share that, not to just keep it as so many people do, as our private collection and only visible to those who are on our Christmas party list, as I've seen in certain circles. So that's all I wanted to say is congratulations.
Well, no, I definitely want to respond. I appreciate your call, Bill. I follow your work, and I, too, am impressed by your scholarship, you know, your collection, and it's an honor that you've called into the show. So, you know, I, too, you know, applaud you for the work that you're doing, that, you know, having followed, seen, you know, your scholarship, like I said, your research and, you know, your collection. So it's an honor that you're called in. I thank you for the, you know, accolades that you've given me. And as you mentioned, the breakthrough moment, and I understand what you meant by that, because the breakthrough moment didn't necessarily come directly with them. It actually came, you know, through a third party. But we had to do some negotiations on that. But, you know, the point that, as you know, it needed to be there. They needed to have it. We just had to get the urgency for how that can be done so that, you know, it could happen. So I was glad when it finally then, but, it, you know, like I understand it was not that easy a deal in terms of, you know, working with and through them in those earlier days.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and I just, there's, as I said, there's a number of people on the West Coast. You and you probably know this lady, Elizabeth Elferson.
Good sister friend of mine. We see each other whenever she's bouncing back and forth. We communicate, you know, beautiful Black Panther archivist. And,
you know,
her scholarship and, you know, definitely good people and love her.
Yeah, I think it's you and her. And you are the two that the only two that I know that have been so fortunate to have these particular items purchased as opposed to donated, as you
I
shouldn't maybe talk about that, but, you know, the backstory on the museum acquisitions was all about, you know, donating.
Absolutely. And no, man, it's great that you mentioned that because, you know, people do need to be aware that, you know, while it is good to donate for sure, that I know in terms of speaking as private collectors, there are many of us, and I'm sure I'm speaking in terms of, you know, folk that we all know, you know, that had been in the game so long that at that point, too, should have been more properly recognized and remunerated, especially because they were the stewards, the initial stewards, and it wasn't about the money. It's about the principle.
Right.
And, you know, having and keeping that and in terms of being with an entrepreneurial bent to it or a corporate bent to it, it could have been done. It could have been done even more expediently in terms of amassing things, where it's all and everybody working together with it, especially those that have some of the rarer things or that actually use those things as we do, either through our own businesses or through our own LLCs or through our own initiatives, you know. So even above being a private collector person, as with you, you use your things also to teach, to educate. I use my things. There are several other collectors I know that actually use them. So they're an active part of what they do, and that needs to be recognized and appreciated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thank you very much. It's an
honor.
Thank
you, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Yes, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Great. Mr. Doggett. Please,
thank you, Bill. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Doggett has appeared on our program previously. He did a magnificent job of his work, his cranking his work, and we're going to be having him back in part two.
I'm hearing a lot of noise and a deep feedback now, though.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. That is because all of the mics are silenced here, so I'm not quite sure what that is. But anyway, I really appreciate Bill Doggett for his work, and actually, we are able to, as I said, we're going to do a part two to his presentation, so I'm looking forward to that in the upcoming week. I want to just let our listening audience know that, you know, we are talking about the retaining of history. We are looking at archiving, and we are looking at museumology, and we have a wonderful guest, Mr. Gene Peters, who has a wonderful collection that he's doing, and he's going throughout the nation, well, actually the world, explaining the history of our people, which is extremely important. through artifacts and the way that he does that and displays it. Our call-in number here is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And if you would like to call and ask a question, we definitely welcome you to do that. We're going to take a quick break, Mr. Doggett. I mean, I'm sorry, Mr. Peters. Bill, I see you on my mind, Bill. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back. And we want to kind of talk a little bit about the theoretical aspect to what, you know, what you're doing. And I also want to talk about something that's going to happen on next Tuesday night that fits right into this discussion that we are having now. So just bear with us, and we'll be back in just a minute.
From us a song. How can we sing? You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, again, this is the Black Reality Think Tank, and we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. We appreciate your participation. We have with us as our guest today Mr. Gene Peters, who has a very powerful collection of artifacts and work relating to the African-American experience. On next week, we have an exciting guest as well and discussion, conversation. Our guest next week is a lady by the name of Karen Marks Mafundiwaka. And I'm sure I said that last name wrong, but it's, I tried once more, Fundiqua. Karen Marks Mafundiqua. And she is a filmmaker. And she has recently created a film called The Price of Memory. The Price of Memory. And the film takes a look beginning in 2002 when Queen Elizabeth came to Jamaica for her Golden Jubilee celebration. And while she was there, she was petitioned by a small group of Rastafari for slavery reparations. For Rastafari, reparation is linked to a desire to Africa, to return to Africa, the homeland of their African ancestors who were enslaved in Jamaica during the British colonial rule. And so this film traces this petition as well as the reparations lawsuit against the Queen. So we follow Ross Lyon, a mystic Rasta farmer who petitioned the Queen, and Michael Lorne, the attorney who brought the lawsuit. In the background are the stories of earlier Rastas who pursued reparations in the 1960s and who undertook a historic mission to Africa to organize official repatriation. The film explores the impact of slavery on the independent Jamaica, following the filmmaker on a journey during which the question of reparation reaches Parliament in both Jamaica and the UK. So The Price of Memory is a compelling exploration of the enduring legacies of slavery and the case for reparations. And she will be our guest next week. She is going to also make this film available for our audience, for this audience particularly, so you can take a look at it. And if you desire to discuss it or have better understanding of it, you'll be able to do so when she comes on the air on next Tuesday. So beginning tomorrow evening or the first of Thursday, you can go to the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page, and there will be a link there that will guide you to be able to watch that film. The film is 83 minutes. It's a documentary, and it does cover some real critical factors. If you'd like to take a look at the website, you can do that. The website is The Price of Memory, the film. I repeat, The Price of Memory, the film.com. And you can take a look at that and you can get a picture. It's really just basically clippings and of it, and but she is going to make the entire film available for us. This production was written by Ms. Mafondikwa, as well as directed by her and produced by her. And I had the opportunity to see it about 2-3 weeks ago, and it was a dynamic film. Excellent cinematography, real top quality stuff. And so I think that you will find this extremely stimulating. So that's next Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock right here on the Time for Awakening.com network, Black Reality Think Tank. And so we look forward to you doing that. And so don't forget, on Wednesday or Thursday of this week, you can go to the Black Reality Think Tank website and take a look at the link. There'll be a link there where you can go and see that as well. I just want to also mention that we, the Time for an Awakening, has other programs that air on the network. I just want to make sure I mention those. On Mondays, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., we have African Perspective with Brother Oshi. African Perspective, Brother Oshi, from 11 to 1. And he is a dynamic program as well. You can use the same number to either listen by phone or either go to timeforanawakening.com and listen to the stream. Also, on Mondays from 6 to 8, we have Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. On Monday evening from 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds, Jihad Ahmed. And then at 8 p.m. On Monday evening, we have Let's Buy Black 365. Let's Buy Black 365 also airs on Monday evening at 8 p.m. On Tuesday, as you know, we have the Black Reality Think Tank from 8 to 10. And then on Wednesday, African Perspectives, again, from 11 to 1 with Brother Oshi, 11 to 1 on Wednesday. And then on Wednesday from 8 to 10, we have Revive by POC, Proof of Consciousness. Young lady has a very dynamic program, and you should take a listen to that. That's on Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10. And then on Friday, we have Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard from 8 to 10. That's on Friday evening from 8 to 10. He has some dynamic guests, very important, outstanding scholars and thinkers that can talk about the African experience as well. And then on Saturday, Saturday Sports Talk with Brother Troy Wilmore comes on from 10 to 12 on Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore, 10 to 12. And then on Sunday, again, we have Revive, Proof of Consciousness, airs from 11 to 1 on Sunday. Revive, Proof of Consciousness, 11 to 1. And then on Sunday evening from 7 to 10, we have Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And those are our lined up for programs. We encourage you to take a look at them. You can also go to our website, timeforanawakening.com, and look at all of our programs. All of the programs are archived, and you'll get a chance to go back and listen to those that you may have missed, or either to go back over some of the things that we've covered. Obviously, this program is also going to be archived. We've got a couple of more callers that came on that have come back. And before I go back to having Brother Peters get back into his discussion, let's open up the line. And we have area code 414-573-1295. Good evening, caller. How can I help you? 573-1295, caller. Okay, I guess maybe they may have stepped away. We have another caller, 336-317-8722. Caller, are you there? Caller, 336-317-8722. I'm not hearing them either. Okay.
All right. Hello, I'm here.
Okay, I know you're there. I have a Greensboro call and I had a Milwaukee call. They're online, but I can't hear them. Let me try one more time. Area code 414-573. Okay, not here. Okay, Talk a little bit for us, if you would, Brother Peters, before you get into the theoretical discussion, about the Oakland exhibit that you did for the Black Panther Party 50th anniversary. What were some of the artifacts that you had that you presented for that celebration?
Sure. I was, they had learned, I've always been a follower of the Panthers and their ideology and, respected. For sure, what the young brothers and sisters of the time, did try to do and even continue to try to accomplish, for sure. So in so doing, I've through my collecting resources, I've had the occasion to acquire certain Black Panther, original Black Panther ephemera over the years. Currently in my collection, I have about 120 full copy original Black Panther newspapers, obviously Black Panther in terms of Warner posters, original first edition books, and the paper ephemera supportive of the Black Panther Party. So they had reached out to me, and I was very honored that they reached out, and I was able to take about 25 of the newspapers, original full copy newspapers, framed and mounted, and set up an exhibit in one of their pass-through hallways where you would actually go from one venue to the other. So it was an honor to, be invited. It was there. It was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party right there in Oakland, California. And I felt, really honored to, meet a lot of the original founding members of the Black Panther Party, and honored to have met Emily Douglas, who is the designer and the artist, the original artist, in terms of having created all those iconic images on the Black Panther newspaper. A great meeting with him and great picture with him, and Sister Kathleen Cleaver, got a chance to meet her, and obviously meeting so many of the original founders of the Black Panther Party, just to be in their honor and their presence, and for them to, appreciate that there are some of us that came up after the movement but are still appreciative and respectful of the sacrifices that they made and what they had to endure, and also what they continue to advocate in advance. So it was a great experience. It was a great, great, great experience. Sister Erica Huggins, got a chance to meet her. And, again, it was just an overwhelming experience to just be in their presence.
Okay, excellent. I'm sure that was. I really, we did a program. We had a brother that came on who talked a lot about the founding. He was one of the writers at the time, and he's been on our program. He talked about it. We did it right around the 50th anniversary as well, and it was really dynamic, very good. So I'm glad to do that. Okay, so let me ask. All right, when you do an exhibit, obviously you have a theme of what you're doing. Like, for instance, the memorial for those that are buried in Manhattan. How do you create that? To help people to get some value out of the exhibit. What is it that you need to do? Do you have to set up a certain thing? Is there a certain image you want to make sure that you continuously portray in that exhibit so that it leaves some kind of a feeling or emotion or understanding of an individual that goes through that? Because if I'm walking through a museum and I'm looking at artifacts, that's one thing. But if they are displayed in a certain way, it gives me some kind of a stronger feeling and essence of what has happened at this particular time. Is that the way you do it? Is that how it's done?
Yeah, that is what I try to do. Usually, I'll try to get like the organizer or the sponsor. I'll try to get an idea of, number one, the space that I'll be occupying, what kind of space that they have for this exhibit. If it's obviously something that I've already curated or one of my exhibits I've actually worked on,
you know, that's one thing. Then I'll know the actual items and artifacts that I will bring. And if it can be accommodated in that space, or if I have to downsize the big thing, I have to be creative with that. If they're contracting with me in terms of a new exhibit, something I've not worked on before, then I get into the design mode in terms of just what items in my collection I think might work, and then the necessary research panels and pieces that I think will complement the items and artifacts that I'm bringing.
Okay.
I'm hearing some feedback now, though.
Yeah, I am. There's somebody in the background. For those of you, I just want to indicate if you are moving around doing something, we can hear you very loud and clear. So please be mindful of that, because I have a couple of the mics open because I'm getting ready to call on you in just a minute. So please be mindful of that. Okay.
Okay. It sounds a little silent now. Right. So then I'll usually get into just in terms of what research am I bringing down, because I'm trying to paint a picture, as you're saying. The artifacts are there, but then I want to kind of give a historical backdrop to it, so that people, not knowing the level of awareness of either the event or history in and of itself, so I try to get a gauge just so I know what artifacts and what things to bring.
Okay.
Then I'll actually go and do the research myself in terms of what narratives or what informational timelines or guidelines am I going to, you know, mock up and create. I work with I have a couple of graphics companies that, mm-hmm. you know, I contract with so that I can actually have them professionally done, produced,
okay. And
then frame, mount. And then it's a matter of then setting it up so that it will tell a story. It will, you know, kind of be comprehensive in the story. It will be historically accurate because I will document, and as a researcher, I'll document and cite everything that I'm putting there.
Okay.
But I want to make sure that the audience gets a chance, number one, to feel the exhibit and to learn from the exhibit. I'm really about trying to, you know, teach people or help people towards a better understanding, say in that regard.
Exactly.
So not knowing the level that they're coming through, but if it's a level that they already know things, then hopefully they'll even see it from a different perspective or a different angle. And then the artifacts in and of themselves tell their own story. So that's kind of the capstone of the exhibit, is actually then being able to be right there with an actual slave shackle or first edition 1857 book or a newspaper, to be right there, but then to have it within the context of the history and also then the setting.
Okay.
That, you know, it's going to be exhibiting under.
All right, let's take a subject like slavery. How would you approach, what is it that you, the main thing you want and a visitor to take away from a display of slavery, of facing a slavery? Let's take the burial ground. What's significant about that history?
When I deal with slavery, that was one of my first specialties when I first started out. When I deal with the issue of slavery, especially when I used to talk to the young people, do a lot more of the personal lectures, my first thing is even the use of the word slave versus enslaved person.
Okay.
You know? So my whole thing when I'm actually there is for people to recognize and realize that these are people, because when you say slave, that's the condition, or that kind of then depersonalizes it.
Exactly.
But when you refer to that individual as an enslaved person, you bring the humanity back to that individual. And also then coupled on the fact that that individual is our ancestor collectively, that's the thing I want people then to recognize and realize. The humanity, to bring the humanness, if you will, that word, into that circumstance. And that's, again, going back to the African burial grounds, I think that's one of the things that really captured me with the production I just worked on, or just what they've done down there, is to remind people of the humanity and that these were souls, these were people.
Exactly.
You know, they weren't, you know, But when you just say slave, okay, that may be a person that's in that condition. But again, no, it's a person. That person was enslaved.
Right. Exactly.
And that person needs to be recognized. So I try to then use that as my backdrop when I'm doing that aspect of that that exhibit in and of itself, for people then just to then be reminded of the human nature of that dynamic, the personal nature of that dynamic, and how that is us and we are they.
Exactly. And as a historian, I'm mindful of that as well. That's I think it's very important. That these are Africans, first of all. They were rooted to a land. They were captured in warfare. This was warfare. And were brought here under some very horrible conditions. And a lot of times they survived. That's one of the messages I always to tell my students, that they survived. But still, it was a very horrible system. Let's go to a caller, area code 414-573. Caller, are you there?
Okay, Dr. Rogers, hello, good evening to your guests. Yes, I'm here. I've been listening. I just tuned in recently.
Okay.
Good evening.
And good evening, and I'm just really appreciative of the work that you've been doing and the amount of knowledge and also the courage that you have taken to, you know, to come out and to talk about our history and represent it so well. I I'm a curator in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and over the past 10 years have developed a gallery studio that focuses on our history. And so it's always a delight to talk with other historians and people who also share that interest in representing it factually. Dr. Rogers has been my kind of counselor in a sense to give me a lot of historical information, and so I truly do appreciate his level of knowledge and what he brings to our community.
Thank you very much.
What I'm looking at is, I wanted to ask you about your how you curate and your show, that if you do take it to other cities, such as Milwaukee. I want to look into that, and maybe that's another conversation. But I'm also interested in the Harlem Renaissance. And so I'm just kind of wondering if that is something that you look into as well.
Yeah, Harlem Renaissance, again, thank you for your call, for sure. Yeah, Harlem Renaissance is one of the particular areas that I'm always anxious to learn more about, just personally, because it was such a dynamic time and, you know, just such you know, just so many dynamic things that were happening during that time that I'm always anxious to learn more about that. Particularly to that time, you know, in my collection, I actually have a couple first edition books that I, you know, have in storage, and also some of the early records and recordings there. But there is so much more to that period of time that I'm still learning so much about it. You know, fortunately, being here in New York, I can access certain things, you know, at the ready. But, you know, I'm still learning so much about just the time, because when we think of the arts and literature, that was really dynamic. But the political suasions that were going on and the ideologies and the differences of ideologies of, you know, our, say, leaders, if you will, or the great thinkers of the time, there were so many different things that were converging in, you know, the village of Harlem, just within that 10-15 year period, you know, that I too share, and just, you know, learning more about it, trying to understand more about it. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because when I first started into my Harlem Renaissance research, it then moved me back, you know, a generation, an era, in terms of the New Negro Movement, and then just to see how the emphasis of the New Negro Movement turn of the century, you know, coming right after Plessy versus Ferguson, turn of the century, and all those challenging and dynamics then led right into what this new movement was, when, you know, the younger folk at the time, at that point, were then trying to get their voice. They were trying to have their say. They were then trying to then say, well, hey, this is us. This is what we do at this point. And that dynamism is what, you know, to me, I found created that, you know, circumstance of the Harlem Renaissance. So, you know, I'm sharing that as a personal, you know, passion that, you know, I definitely continue to try to acquire things of that time and that will relate to telling that story or understanding it, you know, in a more comprehensive manner.
Wonderful. Well, I think it's very important that we tell our story and that we tell our story because so many other people are telling, well, they're not telling our story, but so many other people are telling, you know, they're interpreting it.
They're telling a story.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. So I really appreciate what it is that you're doing. And I hope that we can talk, you know, at another time. I don't want to take up much more time on the show, but I too am a graduate of SUNY at Buffalo.
Okay.
And yeah, and Dr. Asante was my kind of, well, he was one of my favorite professors. I don't know if you remember him.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Okay.
Small
yeah,
world, small world.
yes. So I truly appreciate what you're doing. I have a lot of other questions, but I don't want to take up much more time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you
very
much.
Sure, sure.
Okay, all right. 336-621.
Greetings. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening.
The guest, could you repeat your name, please?
Sure. Jean Alexander Peters.
Jean Peters? Jean Alexander
Peters.
Okay. Good evening. Wonderful presentation. I was just listening. Doc, when you were calling my other number?
Yes.
My cell phone, yeah. There was a lot of noise, and I didn't want that to interfere with the program, so I was just listening until I got home.
Okay.
But I want to thank you, Brother Peters, for coming on and doing this presentation. It's excellent. It's excellent. And
thank you, man.
Doc,
appreciate it.
Yes. And, Doc, thank you, as
yes,
usual, as
thank
always,
you.
For doing great things.
Thank you.
So I want to say I was reading a book called Of Water and the Spirit by Maladoma Somme last night, and for the fifth time, I think. And Maladoma Somme is from Burkina Faso, West Africa. And his story is phenomenal. He was captured in the 1950s at 4 years old by European missionaries and just brutalized, had all of the African brutalized out of him. And I just highly recommend this book. It's so powerful. It'll teach us so much if we can really understand what this brother's communicating. But one of the things that he stresses in this book is that in indigenous African culture, our connection to the ancestors is critical. It's a critical part of our culture. And so not just African, but all indigenous, all non-white. And so I think about our condition today and our disconnection from our ancestors, because what you were saying, Brother Peters, about the bones being, a lot of Africans being buried outside the city limits, did you say earlier?
Correct, yes, ma'am.
And did you say in swampy areas and whatnot?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. So our ancestors were so brutalized and disrespected and lost to us. So that part of our culture that keeps that connection and that relationship with our ancestors was broken. And what Brother Maladoma Somme says is that spiritually, just from a spiritual aspect, that part of why our people are in such a terrible situation, mentally, psychologically, et cetera, is because of that disconnection from the ancestors. And so this is just very powerful because I was talking with one of my nieces, and she was asking me questions about our great-great-great-grandfather. And we can't find anybody past our father. So I can just imagine how many families we just are just totally don't know where our ancestors are, don't know who great greats are, and how it could be impacting us spiritually. So I want to see that out. And I just hear a lot of feedback.
I'm not quite sure.
Are you hearing feedback now? I can hear you. Hello?
Could you all hear me?
Yes, I can hear you for sure.
Okay. So I'll stop there, but that's what was on my mind, if that made some sense.
Oh, no, it makes total sense, and I'm in full agreement with you. The burden then becomes that it's now up to us to recreate our past, to then learn our past. And Arturo Schomburg had said it in one of his writings in terms of that what slavery took away. It is up to us then to recreate that. And it comes from people such as yourself, you know, such as Doc, you know, things that I try to do, to then re-remember. You know, again, we've forgotten. We don't even know what we've forgotten. We've lost it. But if some of us could then kind of get to remember and re-remember even that which we did not know, and that gets metaphysical. But the point is that the ancestors, the spirits, to me, they want us to then know, to learn, to grow, to prosper, to learn from them. They embrace that. And I think any of us that once you get on this ride, you know, it kind of comes to you. It flows to you. It flows in and through you. But it's up to then us present day to help others along that way to then learn what they don't even know that they lost, to remember what they don't even know they forgot. Because once then they get in touch with that, it takes them to another level. And that kind of then will then recreate that broken circle, you know, and it's up to us, you know, those of us with conscious mind and ilk and state current day to then help people along that way and to continue doing what we do in terms of making that connection, respecting the ancestor, respecting their sacrifices, their struggles. And as you're mentioning, many a family can't document past a certain point. I know myself, I unfortunately can't document personally past a certain point, but that never stopped me because, again, I'm going to document for us all. And I'm going to then live, you know, through the village. I'm going to live vicariously through the lives of others. I'm going to research other people's history because all of that is still our history. And that then kind of emboldens me when I can find out a fact of some ancestor I never knew about, not even directly blood related to me, but it is related to me, it's related to us. Right. And then when I can share that information with others, hopefully then that will either then recreate it for them personally, or in terms of just spiritually, that connection to us as a people, mm-hmm. if that makes, you
I
know,
say.
In terms of, Sharing in that regard. So I even look to, you know, even the work that I do, you know, so broadly that it is all me, you know, it is all us, and I am of it all. So when I'm, you know, looking at a document with an ancestor on it, you know, I embrace that ancestor. If it was my great-great-great-grandfather, it could have been, but if even it's not, it is still somebody symbolic that we need to then properly recognize, properly document, properly make known to the world, because that was lost to history. And then where those connections can be made, and many a time people have learned something and encouraged them to do that kind of research, that's what it's all about, you know, bringing it full circle and remembering those that have gone before us so that we can then share that information with those that are coming after us, because it's not going to stop here. We're just passing through. So I'm just trying to do my job right now, passing through. And whatever I can do passing through to not forget and to let other people learn, I'm going to try to do.
Mm-hmm. Ashe. And, you know, as you were talking, it's just coming to me, and it's nothing, you know, super miraculous anything, but just how powerful this work is doing, you know, or how powerful this work is in terms of recognizing and doing something to bring about this conversation, you know, about the ancestors and literally unearthing the bones. I think this is very powerful. I think it has an impact on us as a people. And it's reminding me when I do libations moving forward, you know, to acknowledge ancestors known and unknown, because I typically will do our freedom fighters, you know, and my ancestors that I might know, but to mention those unknown, because, yes, we're all connected, you know, in terms of the African diaspora. Yeah. That is our culture. So, again, this is great. Great stuff. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for what you do. Thank you, ma'am.
All right, thank you so much, Sister Yan. I appreciate it. Okay.
All right.
All right. We are talking with Mr. Gene Peters, who has discussing with us collecting artifacts to tell the history of our people, African-American people. He is here with us today, and he has a wonderful exhibit, and he's given us some details about how it's done and why it's done and what is the impact, you know, of what we're trying to do. The call-in number here is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. Mr. Peters, I want to ask you something that I'm concerned always about. One of my major areas is looking at the history of the enslavement period and some of the damages that were done. I recall a statement, and I can't remember exactly which writing it was, but James Weldon Johnson said that if we are going to address the race problem in America, we're going to have to look at, and I'm paraphrasing it in a way, we're going to have to look at the sexual travesty that was done to our people. He said that's the only way we address the race thing. And I think very clearly when we read books like the autobiography of an ex-colored man, and some of the things that he was trying to say in that publication, I'm very clear that he was real adamant about that. What is your thought on that as an archivist? And as one, in terms of looking at some of that devastation that was done, the rape of our women, the whole problem of miscegenation and what has happened with that, and the mixing of the bloodlines and all of that, that's a history that's going to always mess up stuff when you start getting into things. What are your thoughts on that as a historian and an archivist?
James Robin Johnson, I mean, he's a, you know, one of the personal favorites in terms of just his points of view and what he thought and how he wrote. So I definitely appreciate any time he's mentioning. He's another underheralded person for sure. We do need to address that, not only in respect of and in honor of our people, but in respect of our women and the sacrifices that they had to endure, continue to, you know, like they had to endure, that they then never were able to speak about, and they had to then bear that burden, if you will.
Right.
You know, right. That's just, you know, and the strength that it would have taken for that kind of abuse to have happened and for them to never be able to speak about it and to accept it as normal. And also then for the mate, to then know that was going on and to be able to, and unfortunately powerless to do anything about that, that's just, you know, to a level that I don't think any of us now fully can comprehend just the strength then and that would have, you know, taken. But again, it took a toll also in terms of, you know, the collegiality of our people, the unity of our people, you know, the divided mind and mindset that it then would then encourage in a lot of the people, you know. So there was dark damage that was done, the physical damage, mental damage, emotional damage that does need, and I agree with Weldon Johnson that, you know, to properly address it, it would have to be fully known, be fully aware of, and they have that kind of conscious thought as to, well, yeah, we made it through, but at what cost?
Exactly.
And whatever cost that is, we need to somehow remedy that, and that can only be done through properly addressing that. I, Dr. Joy DeGruy, good friend of mine, you know, and she speaks and writes of post-traumatic slave syndrome,
right,
and speaks to a lot of those issues in terms of now what can we do to heal ourselves. So I think that there's a lot of great, you know, scholarship being done in that area. I think that people do need to be fully honest, fully upfront, you know, in terms of just trying to keep the integrity of the race, trying to maintain the trueness of our people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, people may have different views as to all other races, say, and all other peoples. But, again, where I come from and in my point of view, you know, I'm about my people.
Right.
I'm about the betterment and empowerment of my people. And then whomever else wants to, they understand that, they can understand that. But again, it's about my people first, because my people have been so denigrated by other peoples. And so to the point that I then try to then make my people and myself whole, I wouldn't want other people then to then steal my thunder or then have to then, you know, swayed me that I need to look out for this, that, and the other thing. Then, not to be a separatist per se, but I will say I'll be a separatist when I need to then separate so that I can get better, for sure.
Right, exactly. And one of the things that we're doing here on the Black Reality Think Tank is we're continuing a discussion and conversation on some of the impacts out of the enslavement period. There are other areas that we focus on as well, but this is a key area because there are some things that we have not uncovered clearly yet in terms of our research and our work. And it's only because now that folk like yourself are getting into these archives and being able to find information and data that will support, you know, some of the theories that we need to have, like our guest next week, Sister Mapondikwa, is talking about the enslavement in Jamaica. And,
mm-hmm.
and Jamaica was ugly, I mean real ugly, kind of system. And
mm-hmm.
I know that recently they did a book on Port Royal and all of the stuff that went on at Port Royal in Jamaica. And then some of the other material that is now available, we can look at some ideas and some thoughts. So I want to remind our audience that next week we will have the filmmaker, Karen Mafondika. She is going to talk about her work in terms of called The Price of Memory. And you can look at our website, Black Reality Think Tank website, on late tomorrow afternoon or either on Thursday, that has a link where you can actually watch the full document. And so that way you can be ready when she comes on in case you have any questions or ideas. But, I wanted to ask you that because as an archivist, I'm sure there are occasions you run across things. You know, we had the advantage of people like Oladao Equiano, who wrote about some of that in his book.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about some of the ugly stuff he saw. But I think enough of it has not come out yet, and we need to really look at that to address that.
And I will say, going a little forward in terms of what you were sharing, that when I look to or when I try to then speak about, as you mentioned, the enslavement period and, you know, what our people went through,
right,
I think a lot of times that I've heard people feel a sense of shame to then, you know, speak about it.
Right.
And I try to move folks, and again, fortunately, when I'm working with different organizations, it's people that have moved past that, but I'm always mindful that when I'm speaking about it, and I never want my people and the people I'm speaking with to feel ashamed of anything.
Okay.
Because the number one thing is that it empowers me to be able to speak for those who could not speak for themselves. So because I know that if something happened to me, I'm the kind of person, I want everybody to know about it, paid under story. But again, when I can't let people know about it, that then hinders me. That then depowers me. I like then that if I'm the voice speaking for our ancestors, I want our people to be empowered that, no, we can speak about that. And who are we going to speak to? We're going to speak to the people that need to know about it. Number one, our people, so that we can better ourselves. And number two, other people who may then be the ones who did it. You need to then understand, because, again, you know, that don't ask, don't tell thing, I'm not going to go with, especially when it's then being a disservice to me, my people. That's what you did to them, but that's not what you're going to do to me. And because you kept them quiet, I'm not them. I don't have to be quiet. So you need to then understand and listen. If you don't want to listen, that doesn't mean I'm not going to keep on talking.
Okay, let me ask, is there a future in African-American studies? I think in a lot of academies, there's some dismantling being done. What are your thoughts? And what do we have to do to make sure that doesn't happen?
Yeah, to me, there's always a future of a need for it. But then, as you mentioned, whether the academies embrace it, that's, you know, again, asking others to then do for us, which is great when it works. When it doesn't work, it still needs to get done.
Right.
So I say that to say there are so many institutions that don't even have Black Studies programs, don't have that, you know. That doesn't mean that the work doesn't need to get done. I think the disservice is that a lot of young people don't even know to fight for it. They don't know that they need to demand that. In the 60s, that's how the whole, you know, revolution came about.
That's true.
That the young people at the time then fought for those programs to be then put into those colleges, put into the high school level. It needs to still be fought for in the whole K-12 curriculum.
Okay.
And there have been some initiatives and, you know, inroads to that, not enough at all, no. We need to then figure out a way that we can still get the job done,
okay.
You know, individually, collectively, each one doing our part to then share the information. So that's, again, one of the reasons why I started doing what I do, because I realized that there was just not enough of that out there that would satisfy me.
Gotcha. Brother Timothy, you had closing thoughts that you wanted to?
Yes, sir. Thank you for letting me chime in, sir.
Okay.
And Mr. Peters, I have to say this to you, sir, that you mentioned Dr. Asante. He's talked about a lot in Philadelphia. I know he came from Buffalo to Philadelphia University to start one of the PhD programs in African American studies. But people should not also overlook the Blockson Collection. The Blockson Collection is connected to the African American Studies Department. And Charles Blockson has done a marvelous job. I mean, we're not on the level of Schomburg, but all he has collected, we can give him some time, and we're trying to get where you're at. And I'm going to say this recently. He was donated the Tupac collection, and it's about now, and people are trying their best to break the walls down to see what he has. And I think I'm learning a lot from you on what he could be doing to better what he has.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Blotching. I mean, I've met Dr. Blotching on a couple of occasions, homage to him for sure, because when I first started, you know, he was so helpful in terms of embracing what, you know, younger collectors were doing at the time, you know. So, I mean, his work and scholarship is, you know, phenomenal. And in Philly, Philadelphia, as you mentioned, you have, of course, Malafia Asante, but you also have Joseph Ragsdale, he and his wife, they actually have the Lest We Forget Slavery Museum that they've set up and established down there. And I know Joe Rags is a, you know, collector himself. They do a lot of similar work in terms of the outreach and taking the artifacts on the road. And in fact, I think they just set up their location not far from Mark Lamont's store over there in that near Germantown. It's over in Germantown. I think they have their the Lest We Forget Slavery Museum. So, I mean, you know, there are lots of little things that are going on, and as you're mentioning, in terms of bringing that all together and seeing what more can be done with it. You know, Philly is a great place. I do like Philly. I do like the vibe down there. So I definitely, you know, support and applaud anything going on down in that area for sure.
Okay, Brother Peters, we have come to the end of our road. I really, really appreciate your work and what you're doing. I appreciate you coming on the Black Reality Think Tank, and I definitely will be reaching out to you again. I'm going to keep in touch with you, and as well as I'll be able to see what you're doing and monitoring your progress, because I know you're on Facebook as well, and I will definitely follow that. Any closing thoughts, Brother Peters? We've got about a minute.
No. I just applaud you, and I thank you for reaching out to me. I'm glad we could make this happen. I appreciate the work that you're doing, for sure. You know, bringing the awareness to the people, bringing that kind of information to the people, and allowing people to have access and get it, you know, informationally. That's key and crucial. So I applaud your audience. I thought they were very engaged, they're very enlightened. And that's the kind of thing that we can then learn from each other. We support each other, and then we grow from that. So even when the enlightened folk get together, we can still then grow from that, because it's just encouraging. It's very encouraging. You know, the questions that were asked, just the, you know, the engagement of your audience and with you. So even doing what I do, I get encouraged by then speaking to people doing something similar or just being mindful of that. So I thank you for giving me the opportunity just to share a bit.
Okay. And I know you are traveling, so safe travels.
I appreciate it. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
Right. Thank you to our audience for listening, and I will see you again on next Tuesday. Have a very wonderful
day. Black as you, black as me.